Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very, very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, there's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, as given away by the title, I'm here to talk of the stories of films. And I tend to talk about development stories, production stories, marketing stories, release stories, all the ingredients really that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow films manage to get made. Now, what you've happened upon here is one of my occasional special episodes of the podcast. I'm really thrilled about this as well. It's where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their movies or their latest release, a bit of their body of work. You're going to get a mix of a bit of all of that here because I'm thrilled to welcome to the Film Stories podcast Dolph Lundgren, actor, director, producer, writer. And so ostensibly we're here first and foremost to talk about his latest film as director, Wanted Man, a film that he co-wrote with Michael Wirth and Hank Hughes as well. But also we're going to get into, as you would expect, other bits of conversation in and around his film career too, in and around his life. Just a few notes then, just heading into the conversation. We open up talking about his health. Now, Dolph Lundgren has been very open and candid about his cancer diagnosis, for one, and also about the childhood trauma and the difficulties he had growing up, the influence that has had on his career since. And he put this as well into a TED talk that took place in 2015. So we touch on that. There's one point where we stumble over the name of a Clint Eastwood film that neither of us could remember. The film in question is Cry Macho. I could have done a really cunning edit to get it into the audio, but I'd rather play the audio as unblemished as possible. The audio is recorded over Zoom, so do bear that in mind. I think the quality of it came out all right, certainly no worse than my usual level of audio quality. We very, very briefly touch on the likes of Aquaman 2 and Rocky 4 as well. But we're talking about filmmaking, we're talking about directing, we're talking about the stuff that Dolph Lundgren likes, and we're talking about his ongoing health. And so hopefully you enjoy this conversation. I'm setting it up with a clip from Wanted Man, which is available on digital services in the UK here now. You can hear my chat with Dolph Lundgren, the other side of this.
Your attitude is a complete PR nightmare. You have to save yours and our reputation.
The DEA murders in Silverado. Remember that?
We're DEA!
I got the marshals to agree to send you down and bring those two witnesses back here.
The damn publicity stunt. The whole thing is a joke.
Tell Hernandez to shove this job up his ass.
And don't go to Mexico.
So, you're the great white whale.
Excuse me?
Who's down here likes to give personalities special names?
Sometimes I mess around with movie lines.
You looking at me?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else around here?
Algún problema?
So I'm delighted to be joined for this podcast special by the mighty Dolph Lundgren, who's looking at me now and looking in good health, if you don't mind me saying. Can I start there? That seems important. Are you in good health?
Yes. I went through this medical adventure on the level of some of my movies, but real. And as a matter of fact, you know, I'm doing another scan tomorrow, but the last couple of scans have been very good, and I got different treatment in 2022 starting.
Yeah.
I was misdiagnosed, and I was in pretty bad shape for a while, and then I found this other doctor from Greece. She's at UCLA, and I got better. I don't know if you probably followed up on it, but you know, I got this really different treatment, and things are really good. And there's actually a documentary that they've been working on for a couple of years that's coming out, you know, maybe at Toronto Film Festival. And some of that journey that I took is in the doc, you know.
That wouldn't be the documentary named after one of your most famous lines, would it?
Well, that was the original title, but now it's not going to be that. It's called Fights Worth Fighting.
I love that. I love that. I watched actually before earlier today your TED talk from 2015, and there was a moment at the end of that TED talk. I watched the ending of it twice. I mean, you didn't seem. I don't know. It's just like you seemed so choked up getting to the last 30 seconds of that. And you talk there an awful lot about what's worth fighting for. I just wonder, before we get into the film itself, what was your feeling coming off that stage?
I felt very good, and I felt satisfied. I felt coming onto the stage was tough. I mean, it was difficult to make it a movie or anything, because you're standing there and you have 22 minutes, whatever it is, and no notes, and you're basically in front of these people and talking about something very personal. So it was a big step for me, you know, my recovery, actually healing myself.
And you've been I'm just curious what the response you had to that is, because you've been really open. I love that you've been so open about the challenges you've been through and more and how you've dealt with those. And what do you get when you put your story out? What do people come and ask you about? What do they talk to you about?
Well, you know, I have one example after the TED talk. This is a few years back. I was arriving at LAX, you know, from Europe, probably from England or something in those days, and they moved.
It had to be raining.
You can't park your vehicles out there. They keep you, you know, moving. But my car was there with the representative. Somebody took me out, you know, from the airline. And there was a big motorcycle cop, LAPD cop, standing there who'd left. He let my car stay. So I said, "Hey, thanks, officer. I really appreciate it." And he was a big guy with the boots, you know, and the balloon pants and the gun and the whole thing. And the shades, and he shook my hand and he said, "Love your movies, but I love your TED talk more."
Incredible.
And I looked at him for a second and I realized maybe why he's a cop, you know, why he took that route, because I'm sure he had something. I could hear in his voice that he had been moved by it. It was pretty cool.
I was moved by it as well. I watched it this afternoon.
Most unexpected, you know, guy who would respond to it, but then it seems unexpected, but then when you think about it, it isn't so unexpected.
Well, you're an unexpected guy to put those stories. I mean, you've played with this perception so well over the last 10, and I know you've answered lots of questions on it, but there was that whole period where people didn't assume that your backdrop, your backstory, your studies. It almost seems like you use that to your benefit now, that it cuts through and gets your stories about your upbringing and about therapy and about dealing what you've dealt with, because you're the last person we almost expect to hear them from.
Yes, I agree. You know, it happens that because of my, getting thrust into the business so quickly with not a lot of acting experience, and the fact that I had the trauma, so I wanted to keep working. And I like to be physical, so I made all these physical movies. But that other part of my personality has never really been covered. But, you know, lately, because of the TED Talk and that trauma I discussed and my medical adventure, the cancer journey and all of that, it's kind of come to the surface. And I think it's good, nice for me, but I think it could also be inspirational for other people, I hope, you know.
Very much so. Very much so. But it's a myth, I think, to say that this is new, that you've kind of pushed against this kind of perception. Because I only found out today you set up a theatre troupe in New York in the mid-90s. Yeah. I think it was around the time you were doing Johnny Mnemonic. And both of those projects were trying to push you in a different direction.
Yes, I started doing some theatre off Broadway.
That's incredible.
It was interesting. I mean, it's only very lately because of my trauma, and, you know, it was really hard for me to connect, you know, to sort of be connected internally. And that's what you need to act, you know, to do more complex parts. And I really wasn't really connected because I hadn't really healed. So that's why, you know, I made all of those attempts earlier in my career. But then I had this other side of me, which was, I want to make more money. You know, my wife wants to buy a big house. You know, I had that whole thing going. So I was always, you know, juggling these different balls. But now it turned out that my real life journey has become kind of interesting. And that's sort of taken over a little bit.
This too, if I've got this right, is this your eighth film as director? I mean, we're talking about the film Wanted Man here. Is it seven or eight? Is it?
Yeah,
I mean, there was the point where you directed The Defender, I think it was in 2004. But I've read there you were almost the accidental director. That I think it was Sidney J. Fury was doing that. Did you have the intention to do one film as director, yet alone be here in 2024 making more films as a director than most people even get to think about?
Well, you know, I never planned things in my life. I've just gone with the, like I think we're seeing in the documentary, it's been like a Viking, you know, they kind of go out there and you go where the wind blows, you know, in the ship, you know, you go end up in Scotland or in Spain, whatever. But I think that, you know, the first chance I got was Sidney Fury, and he was going to direct a picture that's sick. And he suggested me, and the producers was, what, who? And then, you know, I'd worked on the script with him already. So I felt pretty comfortable doing it, and even my first time. And then I directed a couple of more films, and then I started the Expendables franchise, and there was three of those, and then Aquaman and all of that, Creed 2. And then it wasn't until 2 years ago, three years ago, that I started directing again. And I like it. You know, I really want to take my time next time, though, because doing these smaller indie movies, you're so rushed for time. You know, it's hard to get to prepare properly, you know.
So I got that you had, 24, 25 days to shoot this. Is that right? So on the one hand, you're doing like Aquaman 2 or something like that, where you've got 25 days waiting in a trailer. And is it that kind of level of contrast? Is it that dramatic?
Yeah, it is. They shot for 8 months or something. So, you know, you're sitting in the trailer. You're right. You can sit all day in the trailer and wait. And you can shoot the same scene for a week or two. So, you know, every moment is like extended like 50 times as long as it is in real life.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, obviously in a smaller movie, which is kind of enjoyable, you live through the scene more in a more real way. You live through a fight or a shootout or dialogue around a dinner table. It, it happens in a couple of hours, kind of almost like in real life, you know?
I got to interview you once before, and it was just before The Expendables came out. And I asked you about directing a film, and you just stopped and just gave me a look, and you just said something along the lines of, I wish people knew how hard it was to direct a film. Is it still really hard now you've done it so many times to direct a film?
Well, it's a lot of fun and it's enjoyable, but it's hard, especially if you're acting and directing, because you're in front of the camera, you have to prepare as an actor. So you don't have to worry too much about your own performance, just focus on everybody else. It is hard to direct a movie. It's a long process. And, you know, I don't think anybody takes it lightly, or you're not, you know, because you're responsible to deliver a picture. And usually most people are emotionally involved. So, it really becomes part of your life. But what I didn't realize on this last one was that I really, I was kind of right. It was during COVID, the end of COVID. So, you know, we're still restrictive, kind of the space, and things happen very quickly and sort of without planning a lot of it. So it made it more difficult. But I think, you know, if you have the luxury to prepare, to take a year or so to prepare, 6 months to prepare it, how to shoot it and everything, and you know, work on the characters, then it's not as much hard work as it is if you're thrust into it, like I have been a few times, you know.
I always think with smaller independent films, you can find a lot of the stories by going to the special thanks bit at the end of the end credits. So I always sit through to wait for that. So I got two things out of your special thanks at the end of the credits. First of all, I can't believe I'm asking you this after asking you about therapy and trauma, but you've got Bello the cat.
Yes.
Bello the cat.
Bello the cat is our little cat's son here, me and my wife. And, you know, we just threw him in there because he was along for the ride. He was in New Mexico and he had to wait for us all day, leave at 5, come back at 7, you know, every day. And yeah, we thought we owed him a little thanks.
Have you just basically got your cat an IMDb page? Is that what you're up to?
Oh, wow. Okay. He will have an IMDb. That's pretty soon he'll have a SAG card. I don't know. He'll have to have a speaking line.
I tell you what, you know how IMDb adds false trivia about people? I'll go in and add a load of stuff for your cat for you and just kind of audition for the film Cats and stuff like that. Let's see what we can make stick. The other part in the midst of it, though, I think I'm pronouncing this right, is the city of La Cruces. And that clearly, I mean, you name the police department, the fire department, the chamber of commerce, the citizens of the city as well. And presumably that was crucial to this movie. I just wonder if you can tell us why.
Well, you know, originally the movie is set in California and Mexico. So we talked about going to Mexico, but this is right after COVID. So it was difficult. We were thinking of shooting in California, and then somebody brought up the idea of New Mexico because there's a tax credit there. And, you know, they were very cooperative. And Las Cruces is a town where Clint Eastwood shot two movies, The Mule and the other one where he's, I can't remember the other one, where he goes to bring a kid back from Mexico. What's it called again?
The name will come to me. I'll cunningly edit it in.
That one. So I thought creatively it made sense because there are a lot of Hispanic-speaking actors there and so forth. And the city, they were very nice, except unfortunately, you know, it turned out that some of the local people there, they kind of try to use, you know, Los Angeles producers that come to town, and things get more expensive than planned. And once you shoot on a tough schedule, suddenly if the, you know, effects budget goes from, you know, 20,000 to 120,000, you know, you're in trouble. So it turned out that we should have probably shot it in California or even Mexico, but, you know, it worked out well and wasn't really, I wasn't involved personally that much in the budget, but I should have been. That will be on the next pictures because I wouldn't say we were, you know, cheated out of money, but you know, you could argue that perhaps.
I blame your cat. That everything goes to your cat.
Could be his. He should have had more power. Maybe you could have taken some of those people down.
I the energy levels of you just seem astounding. I just wonder when you come to write this film, because you're the co-writer as well, of course, and you're opening by giving yourself a big workout and you're running. And so I just wonder, is there a little bit of the practical filmmaker in you that decides to write your character into bed in the middle of the film for a bit, just to almost give yourself a bit of a rest?
Yeah, I think so. Somebody suggested that second act, keep it a little more like, it becomes a little more like a play because, you know, moving around so much. I wrote the script with this co-writer many, many years ago, 15 years ago. And then, you know, immigration wasn't such a big topic and then it became a more hot topic. Yeah. So I decided that maybe it was, you know, I wanted to revisit that script. And then because of a friend of mine, who is an immigration, very, very passionate about immigration or against, he is against immigration, actually. He, you know, I decided to make the character a little bit of a, you know, kind of an anti-immigration person, somebody who learns lesson kind of through, evolves a little bit. And because I came up with that story, I thought it was more interesting to revisit the script. This is about 4 years ago. And then we found somebody to finance it. This is at the tail end of COVID. So it was still, it's been, you know, 5 years between COVID and now the strike. The indie film market's been very shaky. You know, it's been difficult to get stuff done.
You've got another one. You're hinting already. You've got another one set up. Is it Malevolence or something like that? You've got another one coming.
Yeah, Malevolence is something I was working on that is not going to happen. But
I'm sorry.
No, it's on IMDb, you know what it's like. But I am working on another project, actually, which is more of a dark comedy, kind of like noir comedy I'm working on. I'm trying to get the script in shape, and that's set in L.A.
See, I it's interesting. So comedy was something I wanted to ask you about because I maintain your underrated performance is Kindergarten Cop 2 because people dismiss that because it's the straight to video Kindergarten Cop sequel. And yet watching some of your public speaking, I mean, watching the TED Talk, the comedy timing, the comedy beats and stuff like that. Again, it's kind of partly people don't expect it of you, but also you seem to quite enjoy comedy. I'm just curious if you just wanted to push a little bit more towards it.
Yes, you're right. I do. And I think that it's always good to have things people haven't seen or other aspects of your performance, your character. I mean, I do think that, you know, comedy is helpful and there was a little bit in Expendables. I think
yes,
that's
very much.
My first couple of movies, at least, more comedy. And I think on a personal level, it's just, I don't know, as you get older, I've done so many of these action, straight action movies are like serious, you know. Yeah, the bad guys, you know, again. And it's, I mean, it's kind of becomes harder to really get into it and try to play straight. It's easier as you get older, I think, to have a little slight comedic kind of, you know, edge or a prism to see it through, even if it is a serious movie, you know.
Yeah. So what are the films that you watch for fun? I mean, when you go home and you've got the cat on your lap, what are you putting on the DVD player?
Well, usually I watch a lot of television with my wife, and it's sort of movies like, we watch a lot of series like Sex and the City and The Office. So this is comedy or rom-com or, you know, I like.
That's
like,
kind of what I figured you might say, weirdly enough. I could see you as a
comedy. I like romantic comedies. I always did. So, you know, at the Christmas, it's Love Actually or Holiday or, you know, those type of classics.
Are you a Muppet Christmas? I never thought I'd ask you this question. You're a bit of a Muppet Christmas Carol man. I mean, what's your festive?
I love Home Alone 2. You have to watch it every Christmas. Just, I don't know, it's just something about it. And it's that kind of one of those movies you can watch many times. It's kind of a masterpiece. Every line is funny, you know. Every line means something. It's a little bit emotional and a little bit kind of nostalgic. Yeah, I like it.
I mean, do you enjoy filmmaking now? Is it? Because you've said in interviews in the past that you became a star really before you had a chance to explore that and then you've had these ups and downs of success. And like the point we're talking now is just a couple of years that you had two films in the US box office top 10, which I think if I'd have asked you that 10 years ago, you just wouldn't have seen coming.
I agree. And I think for me, the box office isn't as important as trying to,
of course,
find myself a little bit, to express myself a little bit as an artist, whether it's an actor or a director.
Yeah.
Even though it's nice to be relevant. And, you know, I was on my way out many times out of the business. I don't know why, you know, now I have fans who are 7 years old from Aquaman, you know, even though they don't recognize me because I've got the red hair and the beard. But if they do recognize me, they know who it is. So I think it's... I don't know. I didn't plan it that way, but I think what's happening is it's becoming easier for me to, you know, kind of channel my own life a little bit through my movies, which a lot of people do. But in the past, I didn't do that. I just kind of took what was in front of me a lot, you know?
And so when you come to something like Wanted Man, and presumably people expect an action movie off you, I mean, I half joked about putting the character into bed for the second half of the film, but it struck me that was the bit where you put the brakes on and you could have a lot more fun exploring the character. I just wonder if that's what you're seeking. It seems to be.
Yeah, I am. And, you know, I was under a little bit of pressure to have enough action in it to sell it and all of that. But
yeah.
But I was trying to make the action more realistic and not, you know, kind of just for pure entertainment. I do enjoy the character development and working with actors and trying to say something about human nature if I can, you know, and, you know, maybe that's what I'll do in the future, a little more of that and be a little, maybe I'll be a little less restricted in the stories. I feel that already, actually, with this new movie. The comedy, I feel like there's not so much pressure there to make it like an action comedy. It could just be comedy, you know.
Is there anything else you can tell me about that new movie? I'm intrigued.
Well, speaking of pets, it's a little bit about, you know, loosely based on, you know, somebody's pet getting kidnapped. But anyway, that's all I can say, so. So
are you just trying to do a film to put your cat in another film?
Maybe. Bello.
Is that
Bello.
What it is?
No, maybe cat, maybe dog, maybe, I don't know, mongoose, I don't know. But squirrel. But it's just something that I was actually, I had some time off one, I think it was last Christmas, and I had a book about film noir, and I was looking, you know, reading it and studying film noir a little bit. You know, kind of interesting, you know, the visuals and the characters, the way these archetypes they have in there, the femme fatale and the, you know, the hard-boiled, hard-nosed kind of usually a cop or investigator and, you know, this kind of fatalistic part of it. I mean, there's some things in it I like, and especially the design, the sort of the visual language of it that I never had a chance really to storyboard the one I did because it happened too quickly. So my next one, I want to really storyboard it, and I really want to plan the visual language. Like somebody said, you know, the cinema, the what is it, the smallest unit in for an author is the sentence.
Yeah.
You form a sentence, and then you put sentences together, and then suddenly you have a James Joyce novel or something. Whereas this, and in television, it's the, you know, it's about the dialogue, it's about story, but the smallest part in moving part in cinema is the shot.
Yeah,
I think it was Coppola said the shot. It's and that's why cinema is so different. The shot is really important. Whereas in television, yeah, you watch the story, but you don't care so much about the shot. But in cinema, of course, it isn't like that, especially in some parts of cinema. And I like that. And I thought, I never really thought of it that way, but it really is important. I think in good cinema, if you really enjoy it on the big screen or even on the film screen, it's because you like the a lot of times, not every director, but some directors, it's about the shot.
Yeah, I mean, Wanted Man, I mean, so much of it outside as well. It struck me there's a cheaper version of this film, the way you'd have just booked a single studio and just done it all in on two sound stages or something. But the importance of being outdoors.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Like I said, it would have been better to shoot in California, probably. looking back, but you know, next time, what we did say was when we were doing it, like we're gonna. Next time, I want to work in LA if I do a movie.
Yeah,
I want to stay at
home.
Come
to the UK. Come and do one in my neighborhood.
Yeah, UK is great too. Yeah.
Yeah, you'll love it. It'll be fun. I've just read, I mean, talk about film books. I've just read Ed Zwick's filmmaking diaries, which I think have just come out a couple of weeks ago. And he talked there about getting his diagnosis, which I didn't know about at all, just before he directed the film Love and Other Drugs, and how basically it changed how he made films. It sounds obvious and stuff. I just wonder if you could put your perspective on it, but the stuff that was bothering him before just didn't bother him anywhere near as much, and he was able to zero in on stuff a bit more. Is that kind of where you are in life?
Yes, not just when it comes to film, but anything.
Any day,
you know, like you sort of, after you go through what I've been through, you sort of see, you know, life, you look at life differently, and you kind of see the beauty of eternal moment every day. Every moment of the day is eternal and is beautiful. And whether you're making a movie or not, then you kind of, you have a different appreciation for it. And just smaller things don't really bother me much anymore.
I love that. Inevitably, I've got to at least ask one thing about Rocky IV, because it is one of the 10 greatest films of all time. I'm just curious what your take was on the director's cut of it, if you saw that, because I've not seen you speak about that much before.
Yes, I saw it. I thought it was good. I thought Sly did it during COVID. And, you know, I think what he did was make it a little more of an indie movie, a little more of that. It's closer to the original Rocky, a little more character driven and less of an 80s kind of muscle film, which I must say I like what he did, even though obviously the original is cool because it is kind of, it is that era. It sort of personifies that era, you know, the nuclear standoff and Gorbachev and all of that. But I appreciated the recut. I thought it showed a little other side of my character. But I think they were pretty similar to me. I think they're both good movies, you know.
So after you've sat and watched Sex and the City and The Office and you decide to put Rocky IV on, which version do you watch? Because I'm sticking with the original. You know, I'm not trying to offend you or Sly on this. I saw the upside of what he was doing, but I'm firmly sticking with the original. Which one do you go for?
Well, I don't never put it on because I'm trying to.
You so should do. I can't tell you what you're missing out on. If I'd have made Rocky IV, I'd be watching it once a week. The cat watch it.
If I was going to put it on, it would be the original.
Ah, oh, top work. Dolph Lundgren, this is we're pretty much out of time. I think on behalf of everyone listening to this, I think I can comfortably say I hope tomorrow goes wonderfully well for you. I hope we get a chance to have you on this podcast again. But most of all, I'm just glad you're you and keep putting all this positivity into the world. I think it's brilliant. I didn't try and do one Ivan Drago impression either. I just couldn't insult you with that. The very best to you, Dolph Lundgren. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. A real delight. And tomorrow, absolutely rooting for you. Hope it goes brilliantly.
Thank you.
Take care. And that brings to an end my conversation with the wonderful Dolph Lundgren. Wanted Man is available on digital platforms here in the UK now, distributed by Signature Entertainment. You should be able to find that out in the world. And while I leave you to find that, I'm going to also leave you in peace. We're at the end of this episode. So as always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. You can find more from me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. You can find more from Film Stories at Film Stories as well. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, you can find all of our print magazines, and our UK Blu-rays are available for sale there too. Filmstories.co.uk is our website, which is updated every weekday with movie news, reviews, features, TV, games, things like that. If you go to patreon.com/Simon Brew, you can support this podcast as well. Just a reminder though, Wanted Man, available now on digital platforms here in the UK, courtesy of Signature Entertainment. Thank you so much for letting me talk to Dolph Lundgren again. With that, I'm going to leave you in peace. You all take care. You all look after yourselves. I'll be back soon with your regular episode of Film Stories. Bye-bye.